back with another super cool episode of Bankolit, and I'm joined by none other than Ian Open, and we're going to be chatting about fraud prevention. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Pretty cool topic.
It is.
Such a complex one, though.
It is. Fraud is complex. Fraud is designed to be hidden, right? So we've got to find it. You're literally designing something that you cannot find. And that was what makes the job quite fun.
For everyone that's watching this, everyone has either been a victim of fraud or known someone who's a victim of fraud. Fraud has many faces, wears many disguises. What is some of the most common faces, disguises, faces, moduses that you're seeing in terms of what happens on the desk?
It's wide. Really, we have a problem at the moment with scams. As banking systems have become more secure, we talked about authentication. 10 years ago, it was all about channel security. Make sure that you're safe. You know, SMS pins, encryption, the like. That is really come and gone. Because your devices, your accounts are secure, it's now about scamming somebody to actually do something that they don't know what it really is about until it's too late. So really, it's about social scamming, social networking, and a lot of the scams are social. They're driven through social media, and there are scams of emotion. A lot of the scams are around a threat to your safety, a threat to your account, your money. Your money's disappearing. You've got to act fast, and suddenly you're doing things that you would never have thought you would have done in a sane state of mind. So yeah, it's scams. The scams are really wide ranging, from your investment scams. Put your money in this investment. It's linked to a crypto, this, that, or something. Triple your money in a week.
Yeah.
Quadruple your money in a day.
Yeah.
Whatever. There's a scam for whatever you want to make in terms of investments. Invest in eggs. Invest in gold. Invest in crypto. Invest in the JSE. Whatever. So those scams are big. And there's a lot of task scams in South Africa. Task scam is for somebody looking for employment, a side hustle, make a little bit of extra money, or just make some money. You know, people want jobs; they want to be making money, and they get lured into these schemes. You're doing these easy tasks, making a little bit of money. They might give you a little bit of money, $50 to do this, $100 to do this. Take a screenshot of this ad and send it to us. You get $50, and then you pull in.
Got you.
And the next thing you're doing, again, things that you just never thought you would do in a sane state of mind.
Now, Ian, based on the list that we went through, it does appear that there's an element of credibility, right? Investing is credible. Gold is a credible commodity. But what underpins that is a lot more nefarious.
Absolutely.
So there's an element of offering a hook of trust, but underneath the surface, it's a lot more sinister, right?
Absolutely right. So the scammers are very good at building that trust, showing that something looks authentic, whether it's Elon Musk deepfake, Khalifa Reeve deepfake, Cyril Ramaphosa deepfake.
I saw that.
You saw that one, yeah?
That was a ridiculous one.
It was pretty bad, actually.
It was bad.
But some of it's getting pretty good, though. You can't really tell the difference. So yeah, you're going to add a little bit of legitimacy, and then again, play on the emotions of the person who you're scamming. If you talk to a person that's being scammed, they will not believe that they're being scammed. You will tell them, this is a scam. You are being scammed. They'll go, no ways. Look at this. Here's the platform. It's legit. It's crypto. It's Bitcoin. It says they're Bitcoin. There's AI behind it. But, you know, it's all a front. It's there to look real. But as you say, once the money is deposited, that thing falls over. The money's gone.
And fundamental to that are the two most powerful human emotions, fear and greed,
there
in financial markets.
Absolutely. Right?
So you're either monetizing on fear or pushing greed, and it's kind of that interchange, which kind of leads me to our next discussion point, Ian, which is, why are scams so prevalent in South Africa specifically? We're a hotbed for financial crime.
Absolutely. It's become a massive problem. Just in terms of the volumes, it's grown so much. I mean, globally, it's a $1 trillion industry.
So that's
more than $1 trillion. Yeah. South Africa, we have certain types of scams. Like I said, the American market is more your romance scam. it could take a week to 2 weeks to even lure a person in. These are high value payoffs. South Africa, it's about volumes. They are churning volumes. They are just getting lots and lots and lots of the smaller victims. I mean, even your SASSA client is will lose their SASSA money to a scam. And they are prepared to take it. The scams are cheap. They are really at scale. They are scaled. So that's what the scammers in South Africa have set themselves up to do, to really scale. They're quick. Most of the scams in South Africa will not last more than 24 hours. And it's 24/7, the Saturday, Sunday. You will start getting these WhatsApp messages. Are you interested in a task or an investment opportunity? Within 24 hours, you've been pulled in. Wow. And the scam is over. So it's quick. That's quick and scaled.
Yeah. That's fast. I mean, yeah. We're in a country with high levels of economic inequality.
Correct. Yeah.
Incredibly low levels of financial literacy, which is why we're having this conversation, right? To help improve that education gap and close that. We also have people that are desperate, people that are unemployed, people that have time, you know, to actually go and do tasks, to do these things. How do we fix this?
You know, and add to that, everyone's got a smart device for all their money.
Exactly.
At a fingertip. So, yeah, it's a hotbed that we've created, and I suppose it's the perfect storm, which is why everything's sort of coming together at this stage, sort of in your post-COVID era where everybody's online all the time. So what do we do? Look, you've got to be aware of scams. The main thing is be careful of social media. Be careful of talking to people you don't know.
Don't talk to strangers.
Advice number one, don't talk to people you don't know on social media. Why would you want to? Why would you get a financial advice from a person you've never met on social media? So be careful of who you're talking to. If you have not met or touched this person, they're probably not real. They're not who they say they are. So go back to the old way of thinking. If you haven't touched something, it may not exist, and it probably doesn't. So be very, very careful, especially if people are reaching out to you. I mean, most people that want to invest will go and do their research and reach out.
So inbound,
coming to you.
Yeah.
So soliciting a response. So be so careful of that, being pulled into groups where you don't know any of those people. A lot of these are big groups as well. It'll look like, talking about authenticity again.
Yeah, yeah.
There's 10, 20 people in this group. 19 of them are fake, and you.
Mm.
So be so careful. If you are going to buy something, make sure you've touched it before you pay. If you feel like you're being rushed, slow down.
Mm.
And then advice I always give people is don't forget your friends and family. It's so important to talk to your friends and family. If somebody's offering you something online, an investment, a job, they want to use your account to channel money through, and you can keep 5% or something like that. If it sounds fishy, talk to your friends and family. That is your best security. And also don't forget the upwards direction for that as well. If you have parents, always talk to them. Make sure that they can approach you and talk to you about what they're doing with their financial affairs. It's really, really important. A lot of the big victims of these bigger crimes, they often say they just didn't have anybody to ask. So they just went ahead with what they thought.
You know, yeah, like psychologically, it becomes so difficult either when you're so deep entrenched and you need to double down and get yourself out and you feel like you're in control, or when the mask slips and it crushes down on you to realize I'm not in control anymore.
I know.
Like, what do I have to do? Because there's an element of shame that comes with that, right?
That's absolutely right. It's a lot of the fraud is unreported. I mean, globally, we've heard that around 7% of fraud could be reported. So that's 93% isn't. Oh. And that's a shame factor. Syndicates are pretty good at doing it as well. They intentionally, at the end of a scam, blame you. They actually say, you pulled out. You didn't want to make that final. There's never going to be a final payment, right? The final payment is when you have no more money.
So gaslight you.
And then it's your fault. And you let the whole team down. So actually, they almost shame their victims even further. And it's very hard for somebody to admit that they've fallen for a fraud. You can imagine it's shameful. But you shouldn't. If people fall for fraud, it happens every day. And it's not only financially uneducated people. It's people that are fully aware of how finances work. Employed in banks, we have people that fall for this fraud. So it can happen to anyone, really. And the best thing to do is realize when something's wrong to stop. It's almost like that point when you think, saying, hold on, something's wrong here, stop. Because they're always going to try to pull you further in. And you've invested in this thing, right?
Yeah.
Your time, your money. I mean, imagine you've got something that says you've got 300,000 rand that you've earned, and you can see it on your screen. The money's right there, but you just got to pay 5,000 for that release fee or for your tax clearance or something. You're almost saying, well, you know what? I've put so much money into this and time. I might as well put that extra 5,000 in just in case I get it back. And people often do that. They're dragged in further just in this hope, the glimmer of a hope that they'll get some of that money back. And of course, they never are going to. That money is long gone. So talk to people. Be very careful. Always stop and think before you make a payment to somebody you haven't met.
You know, I want to draw that out because I'll highlight that point, which is so pertinent, that fraud doesn't impact a single socioeconomic group, a specific demographic, a specific gender. It affects everyone at every level.
Right? Yeah.
At every education level, etc.
So, I wouldn't believe it. Yeah.
As an example, let's chat about some of the big numbers that you've seen.
Yeah.
When it comes to these fraud cases.
So we've seen some big numbers, and they do range from, you know, the bigger numbers seem to be a little bit more complicated. They take a little bit longer. Yeah. Your big ones are often things like your email intercept fraud. That's a sort of real classic fraud, where you know you've got online, somebody's got hold of your email login, and the next thing they're emailing people. It's similar to, you know, have you ever seen the WhatsApp one?
Yes.
You get your phone,
yes.
And then the WhatsApp, your whole group going, listen, I'm in trouble.
I've seen that.
Yeah, similar to that, but on a bigger scale. So they often will target an attorney firm or a state agent, and then they'll find, okay, here are 5-6 people buying properties. Now, property is going to be 1-2 million rand. So these are people with money, and then they'll say, listen, we've changed our bank account. Please, you know, you need to pay the transfer duties to this new bank account. It's a big scam. Still happens. You need to be so careful. Always, when you're going to make a big payment, just phone again the number that you know and just double check that the number that you're paying, bank account number, is the one on the invoice, is the one that belongs to them. They'll quickly, and take them 2 minutes to confirm that, and it could save you a lot of money. Then the other big one at the moment is your more sophisticated malware type of frauds. And what the scammers do is they'll offer something really, really worthwhile. It's something like a flight, overseas flights to pensioners, 80% discount. Fantastic.
Too good to be true.
Too good to be true.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not true. So 80% discounts on an international flight. You'll get called by an agent. And the next thing, you're downloading an app from the Play Store. That thing says, be careful of this app. You've got tunnel vision. You want that discount, right? You're listening to the guy, and you'll download malware on your phone. It's a sophisticated crime, and it's actually really, really doing the rounds at the moment. And what's quite clever, again, is they are targeting people that, in theory, can still afford the 20%. It's still going to be 10,000 Rand, right? You've probably got a credit card. So they're targeting people with higher net worths, and they're quite clever like that. And then, of course, your big one is always going to be your romance scams.
Yeah.
Targeting usually elderly single people, males and females, building a relationship, starting with small payments. You know, I want to come see you. I've got a problem and I need a little bit of money. And then, but you're going to get it all back with interest because I'm really wealthy. I think everybody knows the story, but it's very sad and it still happens. Especially with the elderly clients, they still do get befriended, and they're really just looking for company, right? They just want somebody to talk to, and next thing they get pulled in, and they lose everything.
And on the opposite end of the spectrum too, right? You have these supermodels in your DMs or messages.
Antonio Banderas,
you know.
Prince Harry,
exactly.
Seen him. He was.
I saw one with Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt, he's there.
Like, just got absolutely fleeced and run
with Brad.
Terrible. I'm like, Brad Pitt took time off filming the F1 movie to to crowdfund.
It's funny because it's so ridiculous, but it can be so sad, and it really is devastating when you see actually the impact of this on these people's lives.
Yeah.
It really can be devastating. I think smaller frauds, you can almost understand, okay, you've lost your monthly income, your salary came in, and I lost the salary or even the SASSA grant. But when it comes to life savings, that's where it's really, really sad. And absolutely critical we protect our clients. I mean, that's what I live, eat, and drink 24/7 fraud, because I really just, you know, it breaks my heart when you see that happening.
Ian, on one hand, you live, breathe, eat, sleep, protecting clients, right? Which is incredibly noble, and it's valuable, and your work is unbelievably important in the ecosystem. At the same time, there will be clients who feel frustrated, because some of the time it can be introducing friction.
That's true.
So you block a payment, you withhold, you freeze a bank account.
Yeah.
You introduce some element of
pain
into their daily life. What happens when you have to deal with that? When someone says to you, "But Ian, you're overextending and you're helping me, but I don't want to be helped."
Yeah.
You know, how do you manage that? I'm sure that happens all the time.
It does. And we get it wrong.
Yeah.
We get it wrong. But, you know, it's part of a learning curve. We want to always try to get it right, but you're never going to always get it right. And I think it's important, number one, that we explain to our clients when we've given them this frustration, when we get it wrong. I'll talk about the other scenario afterwards. But when we do get it wrong, I think it's important that you explain to the client, we are doing this for your interests, and we're sorry we got this wrong. We're going to learn from this, and we're not going to make this mistake again. So I think if you do approach it, you know, telling the client we are actually doing this for you, and apologizing if we got it wrong and fixing it, they will forgive you. And often that is what we have to do. But there are also times where clients are frustrated and you're trying to stop them from doing a transaction you know is fraud. This is where we've got it right. We've actually got it right. And the client is convinced that they want to continue with the transaction. And you know, you've got to really stand your ground. I mean, we talk to the agents all the time, our fraud agents that are talking to these clients, and it's really tough. It can be really, really tough. They get shouted at, you know, told, "This is my money, I'll do what I want." And that's true, it is the client's money. But we really have to try our hardest to persuade them that, listen, take a breath, take an hour, think about this, talk to someone, and come back. And often that will work if they just take that breath, take a 1 hour out of your life that could save you, again, all your money. Then I think clients tend to understand. Again, it's how you talk to clients and how you explain the situation to clients, even when you get it wrong. That can still end up feeling like a win.
Because it's a lot harder once the horse is bolted, right?
And it's impossible.
To go and get cash back, to go and track it, as opposed to just preventing it up front.
It's so quick. So fraud, maybe 10 years ago, you would have 15 minutes to maybe be able to still chase funds. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, money is gone quickly. You know, you have channels to things like wallets. You have channels to things like vouchers. You have channels to crypto. That stuff is very, very quick. Money can move super quick in a crypto wallet. I'm talking about seconds, not minutes. So, yeah, it's critical. In our world, we have to really slow the transaction down. And that is the client friction that you're talking about. So hopefully you don't get it wrong too often. Hopefully we get it right more often than we get it wrong. And when we get it wrong, hopefully we don't make that mistake again.
I think that's so important in framing false positives versus, you know, getting it frictionless from a client user experience perspective, because you want people to have a good experience, but you don't want them to get fleeced, right? But having said that, the bad guys are getting smarter all the time. How do you constantly stay ahead, one step ahead in this race where you're fighting the bad guys, but the bad guys have, they're not now, you know, just fishing, which is a very archaic way of, you know, doing financial crime. But they can code.
Yeah.
They can do digital marketing.
Yeah.
They can do deep fakes.
Yeah.
They know how to use AI.
Yeah.
They have machine learning tools.
And these guys are, and they work hard.
And they're hardworking. They don't sleep.
Yeah, it does sometimes feel like the faster you speed up, the faster the criminals speed up. And often people say, "Oh, you're always one step behind." I don't believe we are. I think we're usually one step ahead, but not for long. So you got to be quick. You've got to understand the fraud. I think it's absolutely critical that you have your finger on the pulse. I've got to know what's going on every day. So data is important. Data is really, really important. We got to know what happened this morning. So we understand, okay, how did this happen? How did this person get around our control? Why did the client fall for this? How can we slow this transaction down? Ask the client the right questions to get them out of this frame of mind. Absolutely critical that we are aware of everything that's going on up to this morning. So yeah, data is important in our world, and then we got to have the buy-in of our fellows in the bank. App is absolutely critical. I know you spoke to our app team last week, and we have a close relationship with them. Obviously, app is the biggest channel for fraud because it's quick, right? It's in your pocket, and the vast majority of fraud globally will always be on an app. So your app controls are very, very important. And you want it to be a smooth, cool experience, right? You know, you're buying something, it's usually exciting. And when it goes right, it can be really, really great. Buying something online that you love, you get it, and it's fantastic. Obviously, when it goes wrong, it's horrible. And we don't want to destroy that experience for a client. We really want to make them enjoy it. But you've got to slow those risky ones down. So when the data tells you something is not looking good, slow it down, ask those questions. And then I think you can try to get, again, a good experience out of a, even a potentially bad situation.
And Ian, based on your experience, do you often see the bad guys being held accountable for this?
So, yes and no. It's, you know, the crime syndicates now are large. A lot of them are very well organized. They're certainly not local. So these are international syndicates, and they're big. So it's a long, slow process. A lot of the big nations are involved, from Americas through to China, and they have to bring these syndicates down from a bigger level, because they're operating in jurisdictions that are not easy to control, especially in Southeast Asia. So very, very interesting stuff going on in there. I would encourage people to have a look at what is going on in these scam centers. Incredible, like you say. These guys are jacked up. They are jacked up. They have IT departments. They have app departments. They have marketing departments.
So full corporate.
These guys.
But for crime.
They're corporate for crime. And again, they don't play by the rules. They don't have to. So, I mean, some of these guys are working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week in these scam centers. It's hectic. It's really, really hectic what is going on these scam centers. Then they have local operations. So we do know a lot of the operations in South Africa. And we do work with law enforcement. So that part we do get to see because it's here. And as I say, we do work with the authorities to take these syndicates out. You've got to disrupt them and take them down. Bless you.
Thanks. So your team mentioned to me that they work very closely with other banks.
Yes.
And that's an important part of solving the crime, because in a banking system, you're only as weak as the weakest bank, right?
Yep,
because then you start to become targeted.
Exactly.
Take me through some of the cool stuff you do working with some of the other large banks in South Africa to tighten their net.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, we always have had close relationships. The nice thing about fraud is it's not competitive. So generally we say, listen, we want to share. We want to work together. We are not in competition. It's not a competitive advantage for us. We want to always share as much as we can. So that works well, and there's various organizations that we work through to share data, to share ideas. Yeah, there's some very cool stuff. At the moment, we're actually looking at interbank fraud models. So fraud modeling is quite cool.
That's cool.
You know, I think it's very, very cutting edge, this work that they are doing. So these are actually people that are analyzing fraud using shared banking data. So they literally will get data from every bank and model, and they'll be able to say, listen, these accounts that you're paying, or these people that they look brand new, their behavior is really strange, I wouldn't pay this. So that's quite cool. A lot of the takedown operations are interbank driven. So we will have common victims, common fraud types. Like I'm thinking of those ones we used to get an SMS to say, there's an unauthorized debit order on your account.
Yes.
So we know where all those guys operate from. They target all banks. So it's actually quite cool to come together and share intelligence on those syndicates. And then what's important is that we build a really good criminal case with the police because we've got the evidence. So we have to help them build those cases. So we do work a lot with law enforcement as well, especially on those bigger syndicates.
Got you. Yeah. So let's make it super simple for all our viewers and run through a case study. Okay. It's a super practical one.
Yeah.
Now, I do a ton of online shopping and buy a whole lot of things that I don't need often. So every so often you get a parcel tracking delivery, a little number, etc. How do I know what the red flags are when I see something from a DHL or FedEx, etc., that I shouldn't click the link, or this tracking number doesn't look off, it doesn't look right? Or take me through the process from that email or the text that I was
seeing. I think number one, always assume that it's not legit until it's proven that it is.
Start from a position of it's guilty.
I would start from a position that it's guilty. Number two, just make sure you recognize where it's coming from. It's a trusted source. So if it is and you use a good example, you're buying stuff online. Everybody buys stuff online. Yep. So at some stage, you're probably going to want to pay a 45 Rand fee of some sort. So always assume it's not legit and contact the company and say, listen, is Buffalo, is whatever, are they your courier? Is this legit? And just verify it before you make those payments. So I wouldn't click on anything. If I don't recognize something, I won't click on it. If the bank has to send you an SMS to say there's unauthorized transactions, phone the bank. Always initiate the phone call going outwards. The bank's number is going to be online, right? Easy to get hold of them. Our contact centers, just Google Captic contact center, you'll get the contact number. Then you know you're talking to the real person or the real McCoy. So I would always keep it simple. Don't do any payments. Don't click on links unless you know that it's legit.
Yeah.
And it probably isn't.
Exactly. I mean, every now and again, you get an email or you get an alert from Google or Apple saying your details have been compromised on some website, right? What does it actually mean from a fraud perspective for people that are looking at what type of information floats out there?
So what they're trying to do is actually to try to get you to log into a spoof site, a fake site, right? They just want your login details. And once they can get into your, whether it's an email address, then they can read your, can you imagine if somebody had all your emails, what they could read?
That's a lot of calendar invites, a lot of conference calls for them to join.
But you're going to have business deals, right?
No, of course, 100%.
You're going to have people that you transact with. You're going to have family in there. They can find out a lot about you. They'll know who you are talking to for business.
Yeah.
They're going to know who you're talking to about family. If you are planning a trip somewhere.
Even your iCloud. I mean, that's every image out there, right? Everything.
So they just want to get to know more about you. And once they know more about you, they can either take your account over or they can use that information to scam you. So if they know you're planning a trip overseas, the next thing you're going to get a phone call, listen, we got a deal for you. Download this app or, take it from there. There's just so many options.
100%. Now, I want to close up by talking about social engineering.
Yeah.
Because at some point you can become paranoid and think, all of my data is out there because we all have digital footprints or fingerprints, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And short of us going and scraping all of that out and trying to live in anonymity in a cabin in the woods somewhere remotely, we're all exposed, right?
Yeah.
So how do we balance having an online presence with not being socially engineered and not giving away too much on the internet?
It's such a great question. And I'll give my personal advice. Yeah. I think there's a lot of advice online on these things. But number one is only share what you should.
Yeah.
Don't overshare. And you'll be surprised at how much people do share, especially on the likes of Facebooks and things that are open platforms. So don't share what you don't need to share. Don't accept invites from people you don't know. There's just no point. What's the point? And whether that be Facebook, WhatsApp, or LinkedIn, I would be very careful. Choose your friends wisely, right? Also, choose your cyber friends wisely.
Yeah.
Same goes for cyber as it does for real life. That would be my one piece of advice. Just don't overshare. Think about if this information or this photograph was in the hands of criminals, would it be a problem? If yes, don't share it.
Yeah. And social media culture, people share everything.
They share everything. They want to show where they are on holiday.
Exactly.
I mean, think about if you're taking a photograph at a school,
they might know where your kids go to school.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't want the criminals to know where my kids go to school. It can be really, really worrying and horrifying if you think about it like that. So just don't overshare. Criminals will use that information for purposes that you really wasn't intended for. So I'm personally careful with what I share online. I will share. I happily share, but only with the people I know. That I want to share with.
Okay. So I'm going to send you a LinkedIn request.
I'll accept.
Please accept. You can touch me.
I've touched you. I've shaken your hand, so I will gladly accept it.
But listen, Ian, thank you so much. Such a cool topic. The way you've unpacked it, it's phenomenal. You made it so simple, so real, and so practical for everyone that's watching it. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And likewise, I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
Chat soon.
Cheers.